May it please the court.
You may proceed.
18 weeks ago today, the people of the state of Missouri entered the polling places and looked at this language. Shall the Missouri Constitution be amended to include a declaration that the right to keep and bear arms is an inalienable right and that the state government is obligated to uphold that right?
Inalienable or unalienable?
It says unalienable,
okay.
Your Honor.
Thank you.
They also might have looked at some point on the wall or another time at the fair ballot language. A yes vote will amend the Missouri Constitution to expand the right to keep and bear arms to include ammunition and related accessories for such arms. This amendment also removes the language that states the right to keep and bear arms does not justify the wearing of concealed weapons. This amendment does not prevent the legislature from limiting the rights of certain felons and certain individuals adjudicated as having a mental disorder. Before this court today, there are two questions that arise from this Amendment 5. First, did the people of Missouri in August repeal in part the statute that bars felon drug dealers from possessing weapons? And second, is that partial repeal applicable retrospectively? The answer to question one is no, which is dispositive of the arguments under the new constitutional provision. The voters' intent in this instance was the same as the Louisiana Supreme Court found in the Drotter case, looking at similar and roughly contemporaneous language. There, the court said that the purpose of the new rule was to ensure that the new federal rule, adopted by a narrow U.S. Supreme Court majority in Heller and McDonald, would remain in place. And so we're in a position now where the people want to be sure that the federal courts do not reduce Missourians' right to bear arms by applying a level of scrutiny that guts the Heller and McDonald holdings. Federal courts have typically taken a two-step approach in right to bear arms cases after Heller and McDonald. First, they look at whether the defendant's possession of a firearm falls within the scope of the constitutional provision. And then, if so, they look at what the level of scrutiny would be and apply that scrutiny. I'd note that the last sentence in the new language addresses or goes directly to the first of those questions. So in using that two-step analysis that Chauvin and other federal court cases have used, there's no reason to even go into an analysis as to whether a violent felon can possess a firearm, because the last sentence of the new language says that those people fall outside of the new version of Article 1, Section 23. So then the courts have to decide if something does fall within the scope of the Second Amendment, what the appropriate level of scrutiny is, and usually they've applied intermediate scrutiny, but not always. In Missouri, we have now decided to avoid that dispute, at least to some degree, because we've embodied in our Constitution a requirement that the courts apply strict scrutiny. And that's a concept that was developed by the United States Supreme Court and has been defined and applied by this court probably exclusively in federal law cases or cases where the court says that our Constitution isn't to be interpreted just like the federal Constitution, has used two steps. What is looking for a compelling interest and then see if the provision is narrowly tailored to serve that issue, that interest. But I make two observations about that strict scrutiny test that are pertinent to this case today. First, Missourians have not defined strict scrutiny. Following the federal formulation for strict scrutiny is not required of this court. This court would normally look at the language of the provision and then look at the dictionary and see if the language is clear on its face. Strict, under the dictionary, means permitting no evasion, maintained absolutely without deviation, inflexibly adhered to or without deviation, and scrutiny means a searching study or inquiry, a searching look.
Is that what you think the voters intended?
I don't know what the voters intended, but I am very dubious that the voters intended that this court has to find a compelling interest and then see if the statute is narrowly tailored to serve that interest. That may be what certain senators who were involved in writing this had in their mind, and it may be what you have in your mind and what I have in mind, but we as lawyers who have some understanding of how the U.S. Supreme Court has defined strict scrutiny are a tiny minority of voters in Missouri. So, no, the court is not bound by that. But second, even if the court feels bound by that formulation, the court should recognize, as the U.S. Supreme Court has, that, and I quote from the U.S. Supreme Court, context matters in applying strict scrutiny. The court needs to look at the context here and see how to actually apply strict scrutiny in this particular context.
So you're analogizing too. We have numerous cases that say when a word is used in a statute, we assume it's used in its dictionary definition,
yes,
and not some special legal meaning.
Yes, and that's got to be even more true for a constitutional provision. When the legislators are having a legislative debate, they are in a position that an attorney such as Senator Schaefer can stand up and talk about what strict scrutiny means. But that doesn't happen when someone is going to the polling place as a lay person and trying to figure out what this amendment is. This court should not feel bound by legalisms when it looks at language where the operative intent is the intent of the voters and not the intent of a lawyer who happened to be part of the team that put together the language that the legislature put on the ballot.
But they put it on the ballot, and the legislature is assumed to know what they're doing.
Well, the legislature...
But they assume to know what they're doing, and the term strict scrutiny when applied to race and sex is very, very... has been defined by many, many... cases.
Absolutely it is, and we know that the legislators knew what they're doing, but that's not the operative question.
How does that argument mesh with our recent cases dealing with the retrospective clause, where this court said that had a technical legal meaning at the time, the cases following it had a technical legal meaning when people voted on it, it was assumed that it had a technical legal meaning that it just applied to civil cases, and we didn't go 100 years down the road and change our mind on that.
The court has to decide which terms have enough of a publicly understood meaning that they can be applied in that technical way. And the court said that for purposes of that case, retrospective ex post facto have different meanings. The court certainly could say the strict scrutiny has a meaning the public understands. I'm just trying to point out the court it should not feel compelled to reach that conclusion.
Wasn't that decision, though, made upon what those who framed the clause thought it meant,
not
what people voted on
at the
time.
It is appropriate to look at what the framers meant to the extent that you are using that to try and divine what the voters intended. That analysis works. But to say simply because the framers intended it, the voters are bound by what the framers intended, that doesn't make sense.
And in fact, this court rejected that very argument when it addressed the constitutional provision saying that the right of employees to collectively bargain shall not be infringed.
Yes.
And the argument was made that at the time everybody knew they meant only private employees, and the court said, well, whatever they may have thought when they put it on, it's what the voters thought, and it said employees, and that has a commonly understood meaning.
Right. Now, that's what the court did in the Independence NEA case. But regardless,
if we go ahead and analyze this under the common federal analysis, why is the statute narrowly tailored?
Well, let me make a number of observations about narrow tailoring here. First, it appears that this is an as-applied challenge, and because of the way that this case arose, it's not entirely clear what kind of challenge it is. But assuming it's an as-applied challenge, the question would be as to Mr. Merritt, a convicted drug dealer, whether whether the statute is sufficiently narrowly tailored that it passes muster as to him, not as to people generally. Second, in the Richard case, this court said that the overbreadth doctrine is limited to the First Amendment. So the overbreadth doctrine would not apply here and would not enable Mr. Merritt to come in and say, well, there may be someone else where this is not sufficiently narrowly tailored, and so it's going to reach them when it shouldn't. That doesn't mean that he can do that here.
The whole intent of Heller and McDonald was to expand the right to bear arms to a higher level.
Well, I think that the court would say it was to recognize the scope of that was always intended for the Constitution to have. But yes. Third, if you are going to go down that road, then it may be that the state has to make some kind of a level of proof as to narrow tailoring. We haven't had the opportunity to do that because, of course, this whole issue arose after the case was on appeal.
So it would, in your mind, it's just positive. It's not retroactive. He violated the law as it was, the statute as being a felon having a gun, and the Constitution does not. Change the Constitution has no effect on that.
If this is a substantive change, then the change in the Constitution can't make it so that what he did was that it was a crime then, but somehow he gets out of the penalty now.
Counsel, I note that, talking about substantive procedural, both parties proceed as if this were a traditional case of expanding the understanding of an existing constitutional right. And the U.S. Supreme Court has said that, for instance, if the it's recognized an Eighth Amendment right not to be executed if you're mentally retarded, the question arises, does that apply to previous cases? Because what they're saying is this, it's always been barred. Here, there's no question of that. This is a new provision. It's not that they're saying the original provision of the Constitution we now realize is broader than we thought, and the question is, should we apply that to prior cases, which is what's in all those cases? It's simply enacting something new, so why is there even a question of retrospective?
That's absolutely right. If it is substantive, that's the right analysis. If it is procedural, then the rule in this court is that you apply procedural rules to cases that are still pending on direct.
But if it gives a new right, then it's not. Then is it substantive or procedural?
I think then it would be substantive if it is really a new right rather than simply.
But as I understand your primary argument, this isn't a new right. This is to make sure that what is perceived as an always existing right doesn't get whittled away.
It is to ensure that what has been perceived as a U.S. Constitution always existing right is not whittled away.
Now, as a U.S. Constitution, I found Senator Schaefer's brief quite intriguing when it came to the issue about the difference between citizens and persons. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court, in this case called Citizens United, which apparently has had some impact, is citizens, so can we then now, if there are citizens, if corporations are citizens, can we now say we, Missouri, have defined citizens as different from persons, as opposed to what the Supreme Court said, and then regulate corporations giving money to politicians?
There are states that have addressed this kind of context by saying that felons are not citizens.
The good state of Utah.
Meaning of this. It's a little more difficult for Missouri to make that claim because we actually impose fewer sanctions on felons than some of the states.
Because you lose civil rights, does that make you not a citizen for all the plethora of other purposes for which citizens are protected under the United States Constitution?
I think whether a felon is a citizen is really a question of how many of the sticks in the bundle of citizenship sticks have to be there before you quit calling that person a citizen. And different states, federal law, take different sticks away from that particular bundle.
Do we have citizens or not persons? Do we have
citizens from a whole different context?
Do we have citizens and also are not persons in Missouri?
Do we have citizens who are not persons?
Persons.
Well, given that everyone becomes a person at the moment of conception, I don't know that I could say that is the case, Your Honor.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court.
You proceed.
My name is Matt Huckabee. I'm here on behalf of respondent Marcus Merritt. The state has no compelling interest in banning all felons under all circumstances for life and the public safety or reducing incidents of violent or firearm-related crime. In the alternative, there's no substantial relationship to the protection of the health, safety, morals, or welfare, and protecting public safety or reducing the incidence of violent and firearm-related crime.
Mr. Layton says that you can't, that in effect that's an overbreadth argument, you can't make that because it's not a First Amendment issue, it's a Second Amendment issue. Can you address it in terms of its application to your client?
Yes. What I can say is Mr. Merritt's trial attorney filed a motion to dismiss, citing Richard, the Richard case from this court, alleging that the felon in possession statute, section 571.070, was unconstitutional as applied to him, and the court dismissed his.
Is this a procedural or substantive change? That's a critical issue as far as retrospective.
Judge Teitelman, I think that it is a procedural change. I would agree with the state in the sense that I believe that what the Amendment 5 did is it changed our understanding of an already existing right. The Heller, in Heller, the United States Supreme Court recognized the right to bear arms. Obviously, it's in the Bill of Rights, it's the Second Amendment. So it is a fundamental right at a federal level.
Well, Heller actually says it's a limited fundamental right.
Correct.
And that it doesn't at all affect the right to regulate felons to possess firearms. So if all this did was lock in time the Heller decision, how can you possibly be successful?
Judge, I believe what Judge Fisher, I believe what you may be referring to is a footnote in Heller in which Justice Scalia states that it is nothing in Heller should be construed to prevent the government from regulating either felons possessing firearms and the mentally incompetent from possessing firearms.
And that same exact language is quoted in the Richard case too, the one that suggested
Correct.
That the Second Amendment was incorporated. So how, and that's a majority view. So how does that provide any assistance to your client?
What I would point out to the court is that the Heller footnote actually created more more confusion than it has.
Might have created more legal work.
Yes.
Have there been any states that have said that the Second Amendment prohibits the regulation of felons possessing firearms?
There was a case out of I believe it's either North or South Carolina. I cited it in my brief. It's the Britt case. In that case, a felon was considered unconstitutional. That statute was found to be unconstitutional as applied to.
Yes. Go ahead.
Under the Second Amendment?
It was under state constitutional.
Well, that's my point.
And here, going back to the. I'm sorry, Judge.
Well, just related to that, states that had different language than Missouri that said the right to keep and bear arms shall not be violated or infringed. Courts have always, in all the states, said that does not prohibit legislature from regulating the rights of felons to possess arms.
Right.
Even though it didn't specifically state an exception, that's considered a permissible regulation. So you're saying this language in Missouri changed that and created a prohibition that did not previously exist by listing certain kinds of felons. Is that what your argument is? And two, isn't that a substantive change because you're giving rights to felons that they did not previously have, you're saying?
Well, what we're saying is both. It is both that under the strict scrutiny analysis, this statute does not pass strict scrutiny. And we're also saying that under intermediate scrutiny, which I believe would be the level of scrutiny that's sort of
But you're not answering my question. There's always been a right of the legislature to regulate the right of felons to bear arms in every state under language identical to the Second Amendment and under the Second Amendment. Courts in most states have specifically said that does not prohibit regulation of felons carrying arms. You're saying it violates the Second Amendment or Missouri's equivalent to the Second Amendment now to regulate felons. So you're asking for a total change in how courts have interpreted that language historically.
That's actually that is not what Mr. Merritt is asking, or what Mr. Merritt's position is. What Mr. Merritt's position is that absolutely the government can regulate felons, but there have to be reasonable restrictions upon those regulations.
But in effect, you're saying aren't you saying that our existing restrictions prior to this amendment were unreasonable?
Yes.
States' restrictions on felons are inherently unreasonable,
unless
they're limited to violent felons.
Missouri statute 571.070 is actually, I would say, unreasonable compared to other state statutes. I think there are other state statutes that would be considered reasonable. And for instance, in my brief, I cite several cases that have a mechanism by which, this also includes the federal government, all provide a mechanism by which the right to bear arms may be restored to a felon. Many other states limit it to just nonviolent,
But the review before when it was a statute and before the strict scrutiny was rational basis. If you apply strict scrutiny, then you have to look at it, I assume, a little closer. And there's also what I learned in law school was the first step in interpreting legislation is the plain meaning. what did it say? And the Constitution said, the constitutional amendment said no violent felons. It did not mention nonviolent felons. If it had said felons should not be able to have should not be able to have weapons, and then that would have been the constitutional amendment, but it didn't say that.
Right. I think the question remains, though, did the previous version of Article 1, Section 23, did it include, or should it, or should this court, had this court reached that question prior to Amendment 5, would this court have limited the restriction on possessing firearms to both violent or nonviolent felons? I think it's a question of interpretation. And I think,
well, I mean, example, someone who transfers more than $10,000 without reporting it, I assume is violated a federal crime and it's a felon. The idea that that person would be a danger if they had a weapon, if it's strict scrutiny, I think that's a little different from rational basis, where you just say, well, there's a rational basis, treat all felons the same, or someone who bounced checks, or someone who was a DWI, a felony DWI. There may be a rational basis, but strict scrutiny may not stand up for that.
Well, Mr. Merritt's position is that it would not pass either intermediate scrutiny or strict scrutiny.
Counsel, let me back up to Judge Stitt's question. Article 1, Section 23, before the election, had been interpreted as not imposing any restriction on the legislature's plenary power to regulate whatever they see fit in any way they see fit, including preventing felons from carrying firearms, correct?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question, Judge?
Well, there was plenary authority to legislate in this area before the amendment, correct?
Correct.
All right, so what language, what word or phrase prohibits what prior was permitted?
What language in the new provision? Specifically, the language in Amendment 5 that would speak directly to the issue would be the language limiting restrictions, or the lack of restriction on regulation to only violent felons.
Well, it doesn't say that. It says that the legislature it is permitted. Nothing in that provision restricts them from prohibiting felons, violent felons, from carrying weapons. It doesn't say anything about the rest of the felon population.
Correct.
It's just silent.
I think, but if you take that in connection with other language in Amendment 5, would combine with, well, for instance, the provision about strict scrutiny. I believe that Amendment 5, as written, would apply strict scrutiny to nonviolent felons possessing firearms, and any regulation of nonviolent felons possessing firearms would have to pass strict scrutiny under Amendment 5. Did I answer your question, Judge?
Well, the strict scrutiny language, whatever that is, it's not a substantive right of individuals. It's a message to courts to analyze statutes in a particular way.
Correct.
So where in the Amendment 5 is there language that restricts the legislature from doing what they could have done prior to Amendment 5?
What would restrict it is the actual standard of review, the strict scrutiny. The standard would be that this statute be narrowly tailored to serve a compelling government interest. And in this case, it is not narrowly drawn. There are other states that have more narrowly drawn felon possession statutes than this one.
But is that the correct analysis, to compare our statute to what other statutes say? Is that the right test to judge whether or not it's narrowly drawn?
No. In fact, well, I think it's informative. I think that the federal law on the issue and other state law would be informative as to what the state of Missouri would do with its own felon possession statute. Additionally, speaking directly to the heart of the matter, Judge, I would suggest that the cold hard facts cited in the state's brief support that this particular provision does not serve a compelling government interest. In fact, the state suggests that violent crime in the state of Missouri has increased since 2011. This statute was amended in 2008 to its current form. The current version of the statute is more restrictive than the pre-2008 version of the felon in possession statute. Theoretically, the pre-2008 version of the statute Mr. Merritt's position would be that that would be constitutional. There would
so
be
your argument about the constitutionality of the statute then does not depend on the language in Article 5 in the new section, does it? What in the new language gives you a right to argue that the statute is unconstitutional that you didn't have before?
I think it's the standard. The standard is strict scrutiny.
Well, didn't previously there was a difference between dangerous felons, right?
Correct.
Why do you assume that dangerous and violent mean the same thing?
Dangerous and violent. Because I think the assumption would be that dangerous felons are those crimes that are specifically defined by statute as dangerous felonies. Those individuals who commit those offenses are. Those are generally crimes against persons. They're generally violent. Many of them require a weapon to commit. But I do think that one of the challenges that this court is going to have is defining what is violent, what is not violent. But going back to my point, Judge Russell, the statistically, if this statute served the compelling government interest of reducing crime and specifically violent crime, one would expect that since 2008, the state of Missouri's violent crime rate would have decreased, which would have been consistent with the national trend. The national trend is that crime is actually going down, according to FBI statistics.
But there's no scientific correlation.
You can't make
a correlation between the gun law and somehow making it more restrictive or somehow created more crime. I don't think you could make that.
And we held in a recent First Amendment case that you can't require the legislature to provide specific scientific proof in order to enact legislation. Otherwise, you'd never have the first act because it would always be begging, what's the evidence first of the effect of the act? We said that's not required. They can use reasonable ideas.
Correct.
So let me ask you another question.
Yes.
Bernie Madoff. Now, no one would think that Bernie Madoff is going to knock off the liquor store, but some would say he was a dangerous fellow. So would he have been, well, he's in jail, but would he be allowed to have a gun or not a gun? Is he a dangerous felon? He destroyed the economy, but is he a dangerous?
He's a dangerous felon, but he's not a dangerous felon by definition in Missouri. Missouri defines what a dangerous felon is.
Thank you.
Judge Teitelman, under federal law, I think Bernie Madoff, I'm not 100% sure, but individuals who commit felonies that have to do with business transactions are actually exempt under federal law. So Bernie Madoff would be allowed to possess a firearm
if he wasn't
in the state
of
Missouri under federal law, but he would not be allowed to possess a firearm under state law, which is a disparity.
Judge Teitelman's question may show then the difference between what is dangerous and what is violent.
Correct.
And his crimes would not qualify as violent felonies.
Correct. And what I would suggest to this court is that this court could look at the federal statutes and could look at the other state statutes for guidance on what would be and what wouldn't be, or at least the legislature could.
What do you think is the significance of the addition of the phrase, the rights guaranteed by this section shall be inalienable? You've had questions from Judge Tiff and Judge Wilson whether there was any change in the rights or whether substantively and whether strict scrutiny was a procedural protection. So what change did the addition of that phrase, the requirement that the rights be inalienable, bring to us?
Judge, I see my time is up. I would be happy to answer your question, and if anybody else has any other questions, I'd be happy to answer those.
Please go ahead.
Judge, absolutely nothing's changed. The right was fundamental before Amendment 5.
Excuse me. Are you sure, or is it a limited fundamental right? I've never seen it described as a fundamental right. It's always described as a limited fundamental right.
You've seen it described as a limited fundamental right?
I think that's what Heller calls it. I think Heller calls it a limited fundamental right.
But it is nevertheless.
So what's the difference between a limited fundamental right and a fundamental right?
I'm not 100% sure, Judge. I've never seen that language used, but
counsel, it doesn't say it shall be unregulatable. It just says it shall be inalienable.
So no, and that's not our position today. We are suggesting. In fact, I'm suggesting that the pre-2008 felon in possession statute would theoretically be constitutional because it has limitations that do serve the state's compelling government interest. This statute, however, does not have the same hallmarks of being narrowly drawn to serve the compelling government interest. In fact, the crime rate's not going down. I'm not saying that that's a causal connection. I'm saying it's a positive correlation. And at a minimum, it certainly says, Judge Seidelman, that...
Is all that in the record here?
I cite that in my brief, but what I wanted to make clear...
Is there record evidence in the trial court below about crime statistics and rates?
That was not raised.
Counsel, is there any... Well, I'm sorry, you're out of time. Go ahead and wrap up.
That's okay.
I've got a question, too.
Yes.
Would you please address Mr. Layton's argument that we should interpret strict scrutiny as its plain meaning as opposed to federal constitution
Absolutely, Judge.
Analysis?
Amendment 5 defined the right to bear arms as a fundamental right. In fact, it used the term inalienable or unalienable. I'm not exactly sure exactly what it said, but it said inalienable or unalienable. That language, I believe, was on the ballot, as was the term strict scrutiny. And if you put those two together, it would be unlikely that a voter would go into the election booth, read that this right's going to be considered unalienable or inalienable, and then turn around and think strict scrutiny didn't have the meaning that it always has.
But what do you mean by always has? There's no. What is the commonly understood meaning of strict scrutiny? Because you're asking us to use it in a way that, in fact, judges use it. Legislators don't use that term either. It's something judges do in looking at legislation or looking at in trying to decide a case. It doesn't have what is your reason for thinking that people in voting on this understood judicial doctrines of review and were tending to enact those as part of the Constitution? What evidence is there that there is a commonly understood meaning of that to the people of Missouri, as opposed to the technical legal meaning that courts use as part of a judicial review doctrine?
Correct. When this court writes an opinion, it writes it in such a way that the public is presumed to understand what this court is saying.
But are you familiar with our many cases saying that unless something indicates it's used in its strict legal meaning, words used in statutes are given their commonly understood definition in lay dictionaries, not in legal dictionaries? And the question is, isn't that, if we do that for statutes, why wouldn't we do that for Constitution? Are you saying the legislature understands less meaning, legal meanings than the citizens of Missouri would in voting on this?
I would imagine that the Missouri legislature would know more.
And yet we use the commonly understood regular dictionary definition, not the Black's Law Dictionary definition of terms, unless there's a particular reason to assume that the legislature meant a particular legal meaning. We have dozens of cases saying that.
Right. I just think that if you look at it in the context in which it is being used in this case, when it's dealing with a right in the Bill of Rights of the State of Missouri, Article 1, Section 23, which even prior to Amendment 5 dealt with a constitutional right that Missourians held independent of the Second Amendment. And you looked at the way it was being used in the context, I think that the intention of the legislatures very well could have been known to voters when they walked into an election, when they walked into their polling place, given the fact that they knew that they were voting on something that would be considered a fundamental right, or that they were going to be either, I guess, not voting for it.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Judge.
Thank you.
Mr. Layton, ordinarily we don't assume unannounced implicit repeals from the legislature.
That's correct.
Given that this originated in the legislature and not as an initiative petition, does that have any application here, that presumption?
I don't know that it could be a presumption because, again, the question here is what the people intended, but it makes some sense to ascribe to the people the same kind of analysis, that is, the people did not intend a repeal of a long-standing statute, as the felon in possession statute is here, without some reference that you can look to and say, there, they would have known that that's what they were voting on.
Is there anything to the idea that, if it were going to have that sort of change to the status quo, that would have been a part of the ballot title in order to make it fair and reasonable?
Well, of course, since we'll be up here in January or February defending the ballot title again, I have to say that if it were a significant change, there, you could make that argument, but we don't think that there was a significant change that had to be reflected in the ballot title. This court in N. Ray Norton said the state has a compelling interest in protecting the public from crime. Mr. Merritt's counsel wants to conflate the narrowing analysis with the definition of the compelling interest and say that we have to have a compelling interest in not having all felons, or not allowing any felons to possess firearms. That's not the way the analysis works. We identify the compelling interest first, which here is to prevent crime, or if we would like to take the compelling interest from the U.S. Supreme Court in Lewis, they noted the receipt and possession of a firearm by a felon constitutes a threat, among other things, to the continued and effective operation of the government of the United States. This idea that felons cannot have firearms is long embedded, not just in Missouri law, but in law in other states. Mr. Merritt's counsel wants to insist that we narrow it in a variety of ways, and let me just make a couple of observations about the areas that he narrows. Number one, if the court is going to go that far, I'm going to plead with the court to say something about what it is that the narrowing would have to consist of, because the legislature needs to know. And there are 1,500 other felon in possession cases now pending in Missouri courts, and those judges need to know. In this particular case, perhaps there's Mr. Huckabee wants to argue that the statute should be narrower, shouldn't apply to all crimes, but I don't know of any state statute that doesn't at least apply to drug dealers like Mr. Merritt. That there ought to be a method to be restored, but when? But more important, as to Mr. Merritt, he reoffended. And so I don't know of any state statute under which he would, at this point, have the right to have a gun.
So you're saying he couldn't say, as applied to him, it would be unfair because he wouldn't meet any...
He wouldn't meet the requirement anyway. And again, an individual adjudication to be relieved of the disability. Again, this is a person who, at the time that he was charged with being a felon in possession, pled guilty to act to two drug offenses on the same day that he was before the circuit court. We thank the court for your attention.
Thank you, counsel. The matter will be taken under submission.